Good morning. Certainly good to be with you all this morning, and I appreciate, as always, the opportunity to get up here and speak before you. I want to thank the elders for this opportunity. I can tell you for a fact, if you ever want to feel like services goes in the blink of an eye, sign up for the 11 o'clock sermon, because everything before this has just been a blur. But Jacob, you did a very fine job this morning. I appreciate your lesson. Shamefully for me, one of the things that I learned this morning is I learned how to spell Isaac. I was looking at your slide. I leaned over to Hannah. Does he have Isaac spelled right on that slide? And she's like, yes, Brody, he does. I was like, okay. I would have had another S in there someplace. So I am not known for my spelling skills, and this was a definite case of that this morning. Today, for my sermon, I had a little over a month to prepare for this, and I admittedly spent the first probably 2.5 weeks preparing for something completely different than what I'm going to present today. I was going through trying to work out my points, and then one day I was just kind of mindlessly scrolling Facebook, going from one Ohio State video to another, from a political post to another, and I happened upon this little article. And while it wasn't written by him, it was quotes from this individual. And the title of it was Five Enemies of Greatness. And unfortunately, as an Ohio State fan today, I'm going to be using quotes from Nick Saban, the former head football coach of Alabama. And I see Jacob shaking his head as a Bulldogs fan as well. So while we don't necessarily in Ohio or Georgia or wherever we might be from love Nick Saban, why is that? Well, that's because he was the coach of Alabama and he won like there's nobody's business. Okay, he was very good at his job. As we consider somebody who was great at their job, it's hard not to put Nick Saban in that category when you look at the body of work and the success that he had. He had this to say when it came to greatness. It's not human nature to be great. It's human nature to survive, to be average, and to do what you have to do to get by. That is normal. When you have something good happen, it's the special people that can stay focused and keep paying attention to detail, working to get better and not being satisfied with what they have accomplished. And then considering that quote right there, I'll switch the slide over. If you can't recognize what the trophy is that he's holding behind me, this is the national championship trophy. He has just won a national championship, and this is the biggest smile that he can muster on his face at this point. Talk about a man who was always striving for getting better and to be great at what he did. I did not do my due diligence to confirm this, but I do know for a fact after one of his national championships, as you can see behind me, he won 7. In 2012, they beat Notre Dame 42-14. He comes into the locker room after everybody's celebrating and gets everybody calmed down, and he congratulates the seniors, says, hey, you guys are going out. They had just at that point won back-to-back national championships. You're going out winners. Nobody can take that from you. And then he addresses everybody else, and he says to the juniors and everybody else coming back next year, that is not how we play football in the second half of that game right there. And he just starts ripping into them. So that there's an example of somebody who was just not satisfied with where he was. He had his sights set always on that next championship or on that next goal. And as we work through these points today, obviously they were intended from his purpose for the sport of football, right? But I believe these are all points that we can apply to our everyday lives, whether it be at work or school, whether it be how we want to be great to our spouse or to our children as parents, or how we want to be with brothers and sisters in Christ, or just we can apply these spiritually. And that's how we're going to apply these today. So five things today that we're going to cover that keep us from being spiritually great. So point number one is entitlement. And with each point, I have a quote from Mr. Saban on this. And his quote for this is, you get up every day, you're entitled to nothing. So nothing is acceptable but your best. When we consider the world around us and our luxuries and the overall quality of our life nowadays, we have it far better off than most people have ever had it in the world, even compared to some people in the world today. We are very blessed in this nation. And how many times does that play, or I often wonder, how does that play into our sense of entitlement that we have? I see this at work all the time. I'll hire somebody who, has the work experience of working at McDonald's and Wendy's. They come into a plant, they want to start learning how to make boxes, and they expect the benefits of a doctor that went to college for 8 years and became a brain surgeon. Those two just don't go together. You're not going to come into a job like what I offer, and you're not going to get those benefits. You also don't put in the same amount of work that they put. But unfortunately, that's kind of the world that we live in. We live in a very entitled world and in a very entitled generation as far as that goes. Everybody wants more, and they don't want to do anything for that. With each point today, or with each example of enemies of greatness, we're going to go through two examples biblically. We'll have a positive and a negative. In this particular case, we're going to re-harp on some of what Jacob said earlier with the prodigal son. I'd like to call attention to verses 11 and 12 of Luke chapter 15. If you would turn over with me there, Luke chapter 15, starting in verse 11. And he said, there was a man who had two sons, and the younger of them said to his father, Father, give me the share of property that is coming to me. And he divided his property between them. Now, Jacob read the whole account for us earlier today. I'm not going to take the time to do that. We have a lot to cover today. So for the sake of time, I will sum up a great deal of the stories that we're going to go through. But in this particular event, I want to really focus on his entitled attitude. What's he saying to his dad here? Jacob covered this earlier. He's saying, Dad, you won't die fast enough. Give me my money. I want my money. I don't care about you. I just want what I have coming to me. And that's the entitled attitude that he had. And unfortunately, that's an entitled attitude we see all around us today. And even we can be guilty of at times. And this does not lead to success. In this example, as Jacob read earlier, where does it lead him? It leads him to get his money by the grace of his father. But then he goes and he squanders it all. And he ends up, not too long after this, feeding pigs, thinking, you know what? That looks like a five-course meal compared to what I'm eating right now. He's longing for the food that he's feeding to the pigs, and how bad that must be to be in a spot where you're longing for the slop that's fed to pigs. And so he decides to return home, and the story does have a happy ending. But again, we want to consider the entitled attitude that he has in the beginning of this parable, and we want to make sure that that does not apply to us. Now, on the flip side of this, we have Jesus' example. If you would, turn over with me to John chapter 13. To set the stage for this is right after Jesus has washed the apostles' feet. So John chapter 13, starting in verse 12, it reads, "When he had washed their feet and put on his outer garments and resumed his place, he said to them, 'Do you understand what I have done to you? You call me teacher and Lord, and you are right, for so I am. If I then, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I have given you an example, that you also should do just as I have done to you. Truly, truly, I say to you, a servant is no greater than his master, nor is a messenger greater than the one who sent him.'" I can't think of a much more disgusting job than washing another man's feet, let alone a whole group of them. Especially in Bible times, when you consider their shoes of the day, their sandals, everything that was on the street, and it's not, you know, paved roads, there's dirt, there's animals going up and down the road. You can imagine what's on their feet, right? It's disgusting. And here we have the creator of the universe, God in the flesh, taking the time to wash his apostles' feet. The example that shows us, the humility that it shows us, is what we need to take away from this. If the creator of the universe can come down and humble himself to that manner to perform that task for others, then what can we do for each other? What can we do to the world around us to help them instead of treating it like, what is somebody going to do for me? And that's where Jesus is obviously the ultimate example of greatness, and I could use him as the positive example for every point I'm going to make today. For the sake of spreading it out a little bit, we'll just use him here. But his example here is one that we should strive to model after. All right, moving on to the second enemy of greatness, it's a lack of discipline. The coach had this to say about this. Run hard when it gets hard to run. Everything starts with discipline. Practice until you can't get it wrong, not just until you get it right. If you don't respect it enough to do it right, when it's the right way to do it, how can you be trusted in a game? I got to admit, that's a very good quote. I like that quote a lot because oftentimes, where would we stop? We'd stop when we got it right. We practice just up to the point we get it right, right? But his message here is you need to keep practicing until you know it so well you can't possibly get it wrong. And I think that's a very good example. So when it comes to being disciplined as Christians, can we say we're on our A game every day? No, I can't. Do we have sin and temptation completely under control? Absolutely not. And while sometimes when we mess up, it's just a pure unintentional mistake, sometimes when we mess up and we sin and fall short, it's because of a lack of spiritual discipline. And it can happen to the best of us. If we look at examples in the Bible, David comes to mind on the roof with Bathsheba. If he had been more disciplined, he'd have looked away the second time instead of looking back at her. Or even Peter, and we consider him and somebody that I probably need to learn a lot from with his mouth. If he had been more disciplined with his mouth and controlling his tongue, we wouldn't have so many examples of Peter saying the wrong things. So I think those are two examples that are very good for this. But for this particular point, I'm going to use Samson, because I don't think anybody embodies a lack of discipline more than Samson when it comes to some of the actions that he had. So starting in Judges chapter 14, and just to sum up this chapter, he has decided to take a wife, and he's taken a wife not from the nation of Israel. And on the way to the wedding or betrothal or whatever it is, he kills a lion with his bare hands, rips it to shreds. Very impressive. Wish I had that kind of strength. And then on the way back, he sees that the lion's carcass is there, and then there's bees that have come into the lion, and there's honey there as well. So he foolishly makes a bet with the bride's family or neighbors or whatever it is, and challenges them that, hey, I'm going to lay out a riddle for you, and if you can tell me the answer within 7 days, I'll owe you 30 garments. And if you don't get it, then you owe me 30 garments. Well, if Samson would have just kept his mouth shut, he wouldn't have owed 30 garments. But picking up in verse 15 of Judges chapter 14, starting in verse 15, it reads, "On the fourth day, they said to Samson's wife, 'Entice your husband to tell us what the riddle is, lest we burn you and your father's house with fire.'" Nice neighbors, by the way. "Have you invited us here to impoverish us?" And Samson's wife wept over him and said, "You only hate me. You do not love me. You have put a riddle to my people, and you have not told me what it is." And he said to her, "Behold, I have not told my father nor my mother, and shall I tell you?" She wept before him the 7 days that their feast lasted, and on the seventh day he told her, because she pressed him hard. Then she told the riddle to her people, and the men of the city said to him on the seventh day before the sun went down, "What is sweeter than honey? What is stronger than a lion?" And he said to them, "If you had not plowed with my heifer, you would not have found out my riddle." First comment, man, if you need to be told this, don't call your wife a heifer. Second point, if he had just kept it to himself and demonstrated discipline in this, he wouldn't have then, if I kept reading, he goes on basically a killing spree and kills 30 people to take their garments to give as the payment for his poorly placed bet. Really, I'm not taking anything. I'm not saying, you know, don't tell your wife your secrets, because, you know, you should. What I'm saying is just don't do anything Samson's done so far up to this point in this chapter. And then if this wasn't bad enough, let's just move two chapters over in the Bible, and let's talk about him and Delilah. Now, in this particular event, we know that Delilah has been bribed to try to find the secret to Samson's strength. And so she asks him, and or tries to sweet talk him into saying it or whatever. And the first time he gives an answer, he doesn't tell her the truth. Then he wakes up that night and he's been bound the way that he said. And he is being attacked. He wakes up, he breaks out of the binds, and he takes care of the Philistines trying to kill him. Now, right there is where it would have stopped with me. That would have been, hey, something's fishy here. She asked me what to do. I told her what to do, and then it happened. Right? I'll give him the benefit of the doubt once, right? Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. Well, it happened three times with Samson. He still hasn't learned this lesson. And then happens a fourth time. So jumping down in chapter 16, starting in verse 15, it reads, "And she said to him, 'How can you say I love you when your heart is not with me? You have mocked me these three times, and you have not told me where your great strength lies.' And when she pressed him hard with her words day after day and urged him, his soul was vexed to death. And he told her all his heart and said to her, 'A razor has never come upon my head, for I am a Nazarite to God from my mother's womb. If my head is shaved, then my strength will leave me, and I shall become weak and be like any other man.'" So he gives in. And he tells her, and I can't help but think, one, this is a lack of discipline on his behalf, but it's also an overconfidence in himself. He is putting his trust in himself instead of his trust in God. And ultimately, we know how the story ends. He's going to be conquered. He's going to have his eyes gouged out, and his strength is going to leave him. Now, it comes back at the end as he basically kills a stadium full of people. But in this particular case, if he had exhibited any discipline in his life at all, he probably wouldn't even have been in this situation to begin with. Now, as we talk about a positive example, we're going to use one of my favorite characters, and that's Nehemiah. If we could, and I could talk about Nehemiah for quite some time, but we're going to keep this short. We're going to go to Nehemiah chapter 4 and read verses 21 and 23. Nehemiah chapter 4, starting in verse 21. So we labored at the work, and half of them held the spears from the break of dawn until the stars came out. I also said to the people at that time, let every man and his servant pass the night within Jerusalem, that they may be a guard for us by night and may labor by day. So neither I nor my brothers nor my servants nor the men of the guard who followed me, none of us took off our clothes. Each kept his weapon at his right hand. So in the course of rebuilding the wall around Jerusalem, they have come up against some opposition. And Nehemiah and his great leadership and his great discipline, he keeps the people working. And they work in a manner to where the work is still getting done efficiently and effectively. In a prior verse to this reading, it talks about how the laborers had their hammer in one hand and their sword in another. They were ready no matter the circumstance. And I think to me, this is just a great example of not only leadership, but discipline and being how the right leader can lead a group of individuals to a common goal and achieve that result. You know, oftentimes at work, you know, being in a leadership position, you'll get around other leaders and they'll want to talk about their favorite leadership books. And I'll get asked, Brody, what's your favorite book about leadership? I'll tell you right now, I'm not a reader at all. I don't like to listen to books. I don't like to read books. I don't like any of that stuff. And so oftentimes my answer to that question, well, I guess my answer is the book of Nehemiah, because Nehemiah to me is an example of a great leader in the work that he gets done in the short amount of time that he has and the way in which he gets it done. I think, you know, if you find yourself looking for a good example of leadership, I don't think you can do much worse than reading the book of Nehemiah, because he is a great example of that. All right, moving on to the third enemy of greatness, and it's circumstances over vision. And what he means by this is getting caught up in the moment and not focusing on where you want to be or where you want to get to. You know, a lot of the times, and I'll use sports as an example, you'll have a team that's doing really good, and they start to hear that they're doing really good. And then all of a sudden, they're practicing not as hard because they're overconfident. This is something that Nick Saban in one of his interviews referred to as rat poison, because it kills the team, honestly, in the end. And we've seen it happen several times. I'd use Ohio State against Florida in the national championship. We heard of how great we were, and then we went and got beat very bad. It happens. But we can do this as well as Christians. We can consider at times our circumstances, and it can be some bad circumstances, and we start to develop a woe is me attitude, but it can also be in the good times where we start to, you know, maybe give ourselves a little bit more credit than we should and not remember that all of our good times come from God. And so as an example for this, I would like to use Joseph. Well, hold on, let me back up, because I'm getting ahead of myself. Let me first tell you Nick Saban's quote when it comes to this. If you want to be good, you really don't have a lot of choices, because it takes what it takes. Okay, so as we consider our good example and our bad example, for the good, I'd like to use Joseph. Now, when we consider Joseph in the story of everything he went through, we know obviously he was sold by his brothers. He became a slave, and then he rose to the top of Potiphar's house, and he was in charge of that, and everything was going a little bit better for him, and then Mrs. Potiphar had other ideas. And so then he's falsely accused of something. He ends up in jail, and in jail, he rises to the top, where he's kind of in charge of the other prisoners. And then he interprets some dreams, and it seems like, hey, I might be getting out soon, but then he's forgotten about for several years. And then finally, he's called before Pharaoh, and Pharaoh has a dream that he doesn't understand and he wants to know the meaning of, and so he calls, and Joseph comes, and Joseph instantly says, well, I'm not going to be the one to tell you what this means. It will be God speaking through me, telling you what this is. And he gives the credit where it's due. And not only does he provide the answer to what the dreams mean, but he also provides a plan of how they can overcome this famine that's coming. And Pharaoh likes this idea so much that he ends up promoting Joseph all the way up to the second in command. Now, you know, with the point being titled Circumstances Over Vision, you might think, hey, I want to talk about all the bad stuff that happened to Joseph, but you're wrong. I want to talk about when his life turned good. So picking up in Genesis chapter 41, I'm going to start reading in verse 46. In Genesis 41, starting in verse 46. Joseph was 30 years old when he entered the service of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. And Joseph went out from the presence of Pharaoh and went through all the land of Egypt. During the 7 plentiful years, the earth produced abundantly, and he gathered up all the food of these 7 years, which occurred in the land of Egypt, and put the food in the cities. He put in every city the food from the fields around it, and Joseph stored up grain in great abundance, like the sand of the sea, until he ceased to measure it, for it could not be measured. Before the year of famine came, 2 sons were born to Joseph. Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On, bore them to him. Joseph called the name of the firstborn Manasseh, for he said, God has made me forget all my hardship and all my father's house. The name of the second he called Ephraim, for God has made me fruitful in the land of my affliction. And it's this here that I want to focus on when it comes to Joseph. You see, how easy would it have been for Joseph to finally have something go right in his life for a period of time, and then to basically not have the right attitude about that, to forget about all the hard times and say, God's delivered me and now I can take it from here. But instead, we see here just in the names that he gives his sons and the meaning behind them, that he still remembers that God delivered him from all the persecution and the problems that came about from his father's house. And then with the second son, God has made me fruitful in the land of my affliction. So God has been with me throughout all of this, and everything I am doing in Joseph's mind is for God. It's a bigger purpose that Joseph serves, and he realizes that. And that's something that we can all take away from to remember. Not only in the bad times do we need to turn to God, but also in the good times. We need to remember that the good times come from him. And we can also see from Joseph here in the good times, he didn't stop working. He worked very hard. How easy would it have been in the 7 years of plentiful harvest to kick back and relax and say, I've got it made. But instead, we see that he collected so much grain that it stopped to be counted or measured because it was immeasurable. There was so much of it. Now, on the flip side of this, we're going to use the parable of the rich fool in Luke chapter 12, starting in verse 16. Luke 12, starting in verse 16, reads, and he told them a parable saying, the land of a rich man produced plentifully, and he thought to himself, what shall I do? For I have nowhere to store my crops. And he said, I will do this. I will tear down my barn and build larger ones. And there I will store all my grains and my goods, and I will say to my soul, soul, you have ample goods laid up for many years. Relax, eat, drink, be merry. But God said to him, fool, this night your soul is required of you, and the things you have prepared, whose will they be? So is the one who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich towards God. Now you might stop and think, well, Brody, your positive and negative example are about guys storing a lot of grain. What's the difference here? Well, the difference is their mindset. The rich fool, his mindset was, hey, I've got it made, now I can kick back and relax. And he was thinking about earthly things. Whereas Joseph, yes, he was storing a bunch of grain to save a whole nation, but his mindset was still towards God. And that's the key difference in this. And this is where we have to remember in the situations where, you know, maybe our lives, and what I want to talk about, maybe our lives are going really good. We still have to keep that focus on God and stay diligent in our work to him. All right, the fourth enemy of greatness that I'd like to talk about is self-pity. So Nick had this to say about it, and there are 2 pains in life. There's the pain of discipline and the pain of disappointment. If you handle the pain of discipline, then you'll never have to deal with the pain of disappointment. And it's that pain of disappointment that causes us to fall into self-pity far too many times, right? And again, as I was kind of saying with the first point, we live very comfortable lives here in America. you know, you can go back even 100 years, and there's things that we have that they probably would have never imagined having, whether it be indoor plumbing. How much do we take that for granted? Or air conditioning, or just electricity in general. All the things that we take for granted that we have nowadays. I know as a personal example, this past summer, at the beginning of the summer, our AC went out, and I said, I'm never going to sleep again, because I'm used to sleeping in a nice, cool bedroom. And it was something, it was like, okay, this, when you think about it, people did this for all the time up until very recently in history. So what am I complaining about? And I did get it fixed really, really fast. But still, it's the comfortableness of our lives that we live that almost don't help us when it comes to self-pity, because we have all this technology, we have all these luxuries, and then when they're removed from us, we really don't know how to handle it. And when you think of the examples that I'm going to use in the Bible here, my challenge would be, and this is for myself as well, I'm going to use Elijah as the negative example in 1 Kings 19, but how long would I have lasted in Elijah's shoes before I was full of self-pity? Would I have lasted as long as he lasted? Would I have been able to go to the mountain and conquer all the prophets of Baal? Or would I have thrown in the towel much sooner than what Elijah did? It's just something to consider. So as we move on and consider Elijah in this particular instance, this is 1 Kings chapter 19. It's right after he's defeated the prophets of Baal up on the mountain. And Ahab goes home, tattles to Jezebel, and Jezebel says, you know, we're going to kill Elijah. That's the most important thing to do right now. And so Elijah catches wind of this, and he flees. So picking up in verse 4, it reads, "But he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under a broom tree, and he asked that he might die, saying, 'It is enough now, O Lord, take away my life, for I am no better than my father's.'" Jumping down to verse 9, it reads, "Then he came to a cave and lodged in it, and behold, the word of the Lord came to him, and he said to him, 'What are you doing here, Elijah?' He said, 'I have been very jealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the people of Israel have forsaken your covenant, thrown down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword, and I, even I only, am left, and they seek my life to take it away.'" Now, in this particular case, God is going to deliver Elijah. He's going to take care of him. He's going to restore him, and he's going to, get him out of this funk that he's in currently. But, you know, you stop and you ask yourself, how can a man that's done as much as Elijah fall into this? And the answer is simple. It's just human nature sometimes to develop a woe is me attitude, or to feel like we're all alone. Brothers and sisters, I want you all to know that you're not alone in anything you're going through in this world. There is somebody else out there just amongst us in this congregation that has probably gone through something similar or the exact same thing that you're going through. And we're supposed to be here for each other. And this helps us avoid this feeling of what Elijah has, of feeling like he's all alone. And, you know, if you do ever feel like you're down, please reach out to somebody. Whether it's me, if I've been through your situation, I'm more than happy to talk. We are here for each other, and this is what I want you to take away from that. Don't get to the point where you feel you're all alone like Elijah did, because it's not a pleasant feeling. Now, on the flip side of this, I'd like to use the Apostle Paul. Now, if there's a man that's been through a whole lot and had a reason to be a little bit woe is me, it's definitely the Apostle Paul. Reading in 2 Corinthians, starting in 2 Corinthians chapter 12, starting in verse 9. This is right after he's prayed for the thorn in his flesh to be removed. And God answers him, and he says, "But he said to me, 'My grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. Therefore, I will boast all the more gladly of my weaknesses, so that the power of Christ may rest upon me. For the sake of Christ, then, I am content with weaknesses, insults, hardships, persecutions, and calamities. For when I am weak, then I am strong." What a profound statement from Paul, and how it's a lot easier to say than to actually live, but I truly believe Paul did live this statement out. And if you'll indulge me for just a moment, we're going to turn over to Acts chapter 27, and we're going to read of a situation where Paul was in the middle of what was soon to be a shipwreck, and we're going to read about his attitude in that moment. Acts chapter 27, starting in verse 33. As day was about to dawn, Paul urged them all to take some food, saying, "Today is the 14th day that you have continued in suspense and without food, having taken nothing. Therefore, I urge you to take some food, for it will give you strength, for not a hair is to perish from the head of any of you." And when he had said these things, he took bread and giving thanks to God in the presence of all, he broke it and began to eat. Then they all were encouraged and ate some food themselves. So you're in the middle of a storm. You've been fighting a storm out on sea for 14 days. You have not moved an inch, not from a lack of trying. You are trying desperately to move this boat, but the wind is just beating, and the waves are just beating against the boat so much that you can't move. And then you have Paul walk up and say, "Oh, don't worry, nobody's going to die. Have some bread." You probably think he's crazy in that moment, right? But as we can see here, the way that he presented this and the way that he truly believed it and he knew that this was going to be the case, you see here that he was able to encourage all of them. It says here a little later on that there were 276 people on the ship. And we know, given the end of the story, that all 276 people made it ashore, even with the boat going down. And that's nothing short of miraculous when it comes to shipwrecks. So, in the hard times in our life, when we feel down on ourselves, can we say that we're approaching it like the Apostle Paul, where we're saying we're rejoicing in these things? They're just making us better in the long run. That's a challenge for each and every one of us as we pursue being great Christians and being great spiritually. This is something that I think Paul does very well, and he's a great example of this to us. And then the final enemy of greatness that I'd like to talk about today is complacency. The quote for that is, "Complacency creates a blatant disregard for doing what is right." Back to that kind of rat poison we were talking about. This is something that Nick Saban was very adamant in preaching to his teams about. He was a perfectionist, and he wanted to make sure that they approached practice and everything they did with the idea of perfection as well. Now, the example I'd like to use for this is Daniel. And really, when it comes to preparing this lesson, Daniel, Joseph, they could have been interchangeable, really, for the most part. But the reason I wanted to put Daniel here for complacency as a positive example is because of what his enemies say about him in Daniel chapter 6. So Daniel chapter 6, starting in verse 4, "Then the high officials and the satraps sought to find a ground for complaint against Daniel with regard to the kingdom, but they could find no ground for complaint or any fault, because he was faithful, and no error or fault was found in him. Then these men said, 'We shall not find any ground for complaint against this Daniel unless we find it in connection with the law of his God.'" Could this be said about us? If somebody was looking for something that we've done wrong, how hard would they have to look? I know for me, they wouldn't have to look very hard. But in the case of Daniel, he is demonstrating such an example of faithfulness to God or a lack of complacency that his enemies, who are looking desperately to find something wrong with him, realize the only thing we're going to find is if we make up a ridiculous rule not allowing him to pray to his God. That is the only way we're going to be able to trap this man. What an example that we have and how we should try to emulate that in our lives. And then on the flip side of complacency, we're going to talk about Moses here. Numbers chapter 20, verses 10 through 12. I know I put 11 on the slide, but we're going to read verses 10 through 12. "Then Moses and Aaron gathered the assembly together before the rock, and he said to them, 'Hear now, you rebels, shall we bring water for you out of this rock?' And Moses lifted up his hand and struck the rock with his staff twice, and water came out abundantly, and the congregation drank and their livestock. And the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, 'Because you did not believe in me to uphold me as holy in the eyes of the people of Israel, therefore you shall not bring this assembly into the land that I have given them.'" Now Moses is, for the most part, a great example for us. But in this particular case, it is a moment of weakness for him. He has allowed himself, we call it to grow complacent, or whether it's anger or whatever it is. He has not followed the word of God. And what God told him to do, which was in this particular case to speak to the rock. He had earlier in the book been told to strike the rock, and that brought forth the water. But in this particular case, he had been told to speak to the rock, and then water would come forth. And so since he didn't listen to this, and the reason I included verse 10 is, "Hear now, you rebels," you can tell right there he's not too happy with Israel at this point. And if we're being fair to Moses, I can say for 100% fact, I'd have lost it on them far sooner than what Moses did. I don't think this takes away from him considering himself to be one of the meekest men on the earth at that time. I agree with that statement that it took him this long to kind of snap on Israel. But in this particular case, he didn't do what God told him to do, and it ultimately cost him in this particular example. It's going to cost him the opportunity to see it through all the way to the end and go into the promised land. All right, so as we consider the points of enemies of greatness, let's now consider what to do in order to move towards spiritual greatness. So first, let's approach everything we do with humility and a willingness to work. Second, let's stay disciplined and strive each day to do better. Third, let's keep our goals facing towards heaven. And fourth, let's stay focused like Paul on the grace and mercy of God. And finally, let us avoid complacency and stay vigilant in our efforts to get home one day. Kind of in conclusion or for the invitation of this lesson, I have one last story for you to share, and then the lesson will be yours. I believe it was around 2017, 2018. Nick Saban had a running back playing for him. I believe his name was Damian Harris. He was a senior at the time. He was a captain, leader of the football team. And one of the rules around Alabama football, I think it was rule 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, don't be late to a Nick Saban meeting. And this particular running back had been with him for 4 years and never missed a meeting, was always on time. Well, one day he overslept his alarm and he was running late. So he reaches out to his position coach and his offensive coordinator and he says, "Hey, I'm running late. What should I do when I get there?" And they told him, "Hey, just kind of quietly, don't make a scene, come in the back and we'll figure out where to go from there." So he gets there, he's about 20 minutes late, and the whole meeting goes by. Nick Saban never says anything to him. So he's like, "Okay, that was weird." He goes out to practice, and again, the coach doesn't say anything to him. And he's like, "Okay, maybe I'm getting away with this. I'm going to be all right." The whole week goes by, and nothing's ever said. So by the time game day comes around, he's completely forgot all about this. He has forgot all about that he was late for the meeting. Right before they're about to run out to the field, Nick Saban pulls him aside and says, "Damian, we need to talk." He's like, "Okay, coach, what's up?" He's like, "Damian, your job today is to be a cheerleader for your team and to be a captain, but you're on the sideline today. You're not going to play a snap." He's, "What do you mean, coach?" He's like, "Just because I was late for the meeting?" And what he said, it stuck with this man, and it stuck with me ever since I heard it. He said, "You're not going to play today, not because you're late to my meeting, but because you weren't man enough to admit that you were wrong and come to me and talk about it and take responsibility for your actions." And that's something as we consider extending an invitation, I think it applies very well. So if you have anything in your life that you need to take accountability for, or you have anything in your life that you need prayers for, don't wait. Come forward now as we stand and sing.